Hi, everybody. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. So what I'm going to talk about is some of the qualitative research. And there's many different parts of the qualitative research, as Paula pointed out, in this project. So I'm just going to talk about one part of it. And that's some research that all of the sites and our national team did around planning. So the title is Planning a Multi-Site Homelessness Research Demonstration Project for People with Mental Illness, the Relationships Between the National and Local Teams in the At-Home Shayswa Project. I think I can skip all of this, Paula, thank you, because I think you covered all of these issues,
so
that's good. So that saves that. This is just a little map of Canada here. I'll just show you, everybody up on their Canadian geography over here. Really? Okay, you know where Moncton is? Boy, you are good. Oh, man. All right. Well, I'll tell you, that's very impressive. Yeah. That was our Planted Canadian in the audience. But we also have the sites, as Paula mentioned, in Montreal in the east and in Toronto in the east, and then one out on the prairies in Winnipeg and Vancouver on the far west coast. So it's quite diverse. They're quite diverse communities, culturally, socially, politically. There are vast differences across these where we're trying to do kind of a standardized, randomized controlled trial. This, I think we've also, Paula, covered too, so I'm just going to skip through this. We have, just the other thing to add that Sam's going to talk about is fidelity assessments have been conducted at 1 year, and they will be done at 2 years into the intervention. I can't explain that. Yeah. Well, let me just say a couple of things about the planning literature. We've looked at this, and first of all, there's not a great deal of literature on mental health planning, but what there is in health planning in general emphasizes sort of more of a rational, instrumental, and technical approach with a focus on tasks, steps, and outcomes. One example would be Larry Green and Kreuter's precede-proceed model. There are others as well, but it all seems very neat and tidy in how you bring an evidence-based program into community with the community's participation. The other thing that I'd like to say about planning approaches is they're also often driven by expert with varying degrees of community engagement. And so what you heard from Paula is there was a lot of community engagement in this whole process because really there was a whole consultation process before the request for applications came forward for this particular project. There were five communities and there was a negotiation back and forth about what the nature of the project would be. So I want to say that in these models and the expert approach, the inherent messiness, conflict, politics, challenges, and lived experience of stakeholders haven't received very much attention. They're really backgrounded, and we know these things are messy. We just don't conceptualize them that way or write about them very much. So we wanted to get into the mess and find out about it. The purpose of this particular part of the project was to tell the story about how the sites came together to develop a proposal and plan programs and to understand what worked well and what didn't work well in the planning process. So there are a number of topics that we explored through open-ended qualitative interviews at each of the sites, and those included things like the planning environment, who the stakeholders and partners were, the relationships, and a variety of other topics that you can see listed here. We ask about all of those. Our methodology, we really assumed a social constructivist approach where it's people's perceptions and constructions of the planning process that what were was of interest to us. How do they conceive what happened in their communities, in their relationships with the different stakeholders? Multiple case study, there's the five sites, and we interviewed across the sites 75 key informants. Those are the people who are most centrally involved in the planning. And then in addition, we did 10 focus groups with another 56 people who were part of the project planning, but they weren't as centrally involved. All of these interviews were audio recorded, transcribed, and each of the sites did theme coding to produce a site report. Then our national team, which is a smaller group with Myra Pia, myself, Myra's from the Douglas Hospital, a smaller group of us then went through these reports and put together a cross-site report and negotiated back with the sites and got feedback just as the sites went back to their stakeholders to get verification. So some of the, just a sample question would be, how did the Mental Health Commission of Canada and the local environment influence the planning and proposal development process? And then there's some probes that we could ask, like what parameters were set in the request for applications that facilitated the planning process, what challenged it, what were some characteristics of the community context that facilitated the planning process or challenged it. So we use this in these interviews that we did with the stakeholders in the communities. And the time covered was really from the time from the request of for applications. As one person put it on our national research team, it's from the time that hit people's inboxes, and then it was sort of like, go, okay, now you're ready, here's the request for proposals, and you start to plan, until the time the project actually started to function and enroll people in the study. So I guess the main thing to say out of this is the findings really underscored the relational nature of planning. It's all about the relationships among the different stakeholders. And there are several sets of relationships that we looked at in our cross-site report. The one that I'm going to talk about with you in a minute is the relationships between the sites and the National Research Team and the Mental Health Commission. So this is a centrally developed project with certain parameters, and then there's each of the local sites. So what was that dynamic or that relationship like? That's what I'm going to talk about. There are other relationships that are important to talk about, and those include the relationships among the stakeholders within each of the sites. So that's all about the community collaboration, and it's like the stakeholder map that Paula showed you. How do all those folks come together and work? And then the last is, as Paula mentioned in her presentation, there was a principle about involvement of people with lived experience. So how do in this process, were there relationships formed with disenfranchised people, mental health consumers, Aboriginal people, people from different racialized backgrounds? So in terms of the relationships between the sites and the national group, I'm going to talk about four parts of this, the first of which is the opportunities. So universally, at each of the sites, the project was viewed as an opportunity for innovation, a well-resourced project that addressed a serious social problem. And there was a lot of excitement about the approach and being included in it. So it's not just that individuals were appreciative of getting housing, it's that the communities were appreciative of being included in a part of such a study. The project also provided opportunities to bring in disenfranchised groups and less recognized players, like landlords and the services for homeless people, shelters, in a coordinated way with other stakeholders. And I think one of the things that people saw as a real opportunity was the Housing First model itself. It was perceived as being innovative and having the potential to influence public policy. Some places had Housing First in place beforehand, most did not. And for most, this was something really different for them. There were challenges at the same time. Bringing together stakeholders who hadn't worked together before to put together a local proposal for services and research. And some sites had more capacity, some less capacity than others, to put together a coherent proposal along the themes of the request for applications. The timelines were tight too. So I think Paula, remind me, but it went out in like October or something, and it had to be turned around within 3 months or?
End of January. Yeah.
End of January. So that's pretty tight to bring all of these people together. One of the challenges was that people expected to have control over this, but since it is a randomized controlled trial, it's relatively standardized, and part of the intervention, of course, is predetermined. There were also issues that people perceived about the research and the randomized controlled design. Cynicism and mistrust about this being a research project where some people weren't going to have services was sort of anathema to some of the people in the service sector, as it always is, that what do you mean? Some of these people aren't going to get treatment? No, well, some of them aren't. That's not the nature of the particular project. So there was work that needed to be done around building trust and gaining credibility and stressing the importance of this kind of a research approach. And another one was the concern that this approach would diminish the value of local approaches. So at least in a couple of the sites, right, they had homegrown approaches that were very valued. And this was seen as a threat or as something that was coming in that challenged their belief in what they were doing. In terms of what worked well in the planning process, one of the I think strategic move of the Mental Health Commission and the National Research Team was they did not make this a competitive process. They had each city put in one proposal. And I think that was really important for bringing the stakeholders together so they're working together and not competing. The timelines, which everybody complained about, they also said it really got us going fast. And not only did we get going fast, we bonded really quickly, too, so it had an impact on the community. They also saw the flexibility of the commission. There was a lot of negotiation, give and take, back and forth around things. For example, the budget was one, so there were just trading and negotiating around budget issues. Another thing that was very important, was not as stressed as much in Paula's opening talk, is that each site had the potential to develop their own site-specific program. And each site, I think initially did that. One no longer has it in quite the form it started out as. But there are particular things, like there's an Aboriginal-focused intensive case management program in Winnipeg, for example. Each of the sites has something like this. Also, the overall collaborative style of the commission and its staff in negotiations perceived as committed, available, and responsive. In the process of doing the planning, while that happened too, the commission hired local site coordinators, and their leadership was seen as very instrumental in helping that planning process unfold and bring people together. What didn't work as well, there was confusion and there were tensions regarding the leadership and who should be involved. So this is around the sites, people jockeying for position, who's in, who's out, whose voice is the loudest. There were those issues that were there, especially at the beginning. There was the issue of lack of clarity about what was negotiable and what was not. Some people thought the RFA was vague. Others thought it was flexible. Some people thought it was vague and flexible. It changed over time. And this is the evolving nature of these kind of interventions. They are purposefully partially open to discussion. Communication problems. There were communication problems. And just one example would be the French language issue. So sometimes it's, you're working on a tight timeline. You have to get the materials out in French and English, and sometimes it doesn't always work out the way we would like. Insufficient time to engage disenfranchised groups in some sites, and some people thought that there was a lack of transparency in how decisions were made. So these are some of the challenges that were mentioned. These are the conclusions and some of the conclusions and lessons learned that we pull together from this portion of the planning exercise that happened. I think there's five conclusions and a lesson for each of them. I think one thing that's really important to understand in a project like this, as social, you know, constructionism is a good fit for this because there are multiple and competing worldviews. Service providers and researchers don't see the world the same way. Aboriginals and non-Aboriginals don't. Consumers and mental health professionals oftentimes haven't. So there needs to be explicit steps taken to acknowledge and normalize that these are differences, as well as developing a shared vision for the project. And that did happen around the whole theme of the housing first model, where people came together and started to see that as sort of a cohesive philosophy. Balancing collaboration with competing factors is a second conclusion. So it's important to be inclusive and collaborative. It's also important to get the job done and move the project forward. So you're always on this sort of like balancing act of how much have we discussed it, how far can we collaborate, we're on a timeline, we need to get these proposals in. So we need to ensure, the lesson is to ensure that different parties arrive at consistent expectations about what levels of collaboration is possible within the context of an RCT design. So it might be helpful from our learning out of this to have like some explicit statements that would be helpful to others when they're planning something like this. Another conclusion is around the importance of bringing in the right people and partners. I think people were very strategically selected for the research, the service, and the sites to get involved in this. People who knew how to partner, work together, and people who would also mediate and could mediate these different worldviews. So it's important to recruit people who are these bridgers, I think, and they can work across worldviews, different stakeholder groups. To a large extent, the coordinators played that role in the project, and they had experience in different worlds. In one site, we had someone who's a service provider. She's also been a federal politician, and she knows everybody. I think she has everybody's perspective. The evolution of a shared commitment to the project, the value of the housing first model, the importance of the site coordinators, and the collaborative working style. So this is the shared commitment. I think there's a need to be a vision that creates a climate of hope, bridges those differences, and moves the project forward. And I think that's one of the things over time the project's been very successful at doing. There are ethical issues, and we have our ethics consultant here with us today. People did have concerns about the randomized controlled trial design and randomization, particularly for people who would be getting treatment as usual. And the other ethical issue was the sustainability of the project past the demonstration period. So this is an area now where we're continuing to direct our energies towards not only sustainability of the project, but its expansion. So that people with mental illness in Canada who've been homeless don't have to live in homelessness. They get a home. So that's it. So I'll, I think,
yeah,
Paul, I
got us back on time.
I got us back on time. So do I get a reward? Do I get a question?
Yeah. Okay.